Imagine you're sitting there listening to the first ever reading of Mark's Gospel. Remember that most ancient people did their reading with their ears and not their eyes. They'd be in the audience while a trained reader read it out loud. We're 3/4 of an hour into it, and looking at the papyrus scroll he's holding, it looks as if the reader is about halfway through. But there's something funny going on. We're hearing stuff we've sort of heard before. Now, don't get me wrong. This is definitely the only time Jesus goes up a mountain with 3 disciples, wears clothes that look as if they've come out of a soap powder advert, and has a chat with 2 famous Old Testament characters who've not been around for hundreds of years. It's definitely a one-off story. But there are 1 or 2 things that sound familiar. We've been here before. Jesus in the middle of the action. A voice coming from somewhere up there saying that Jesus is his much loved son he's very pleased with. And are we imagining it? Or did something get said about Elijah? The penny starts to drop. And yes, it was that bit at the beginning when Jesus was baptized. That was pretty much what God said then. But what made us think about Elijah? He didn't get a mention then, did he? The main character in that story, apart from Jesus, was John the Baptist. You wouldn't think he and Elijah had much in common. The last anyone sees of Elijah in the Old Testament is when his fellow prophet Elisha sees him carried off to heaven in a chariot of fire, apparently without dying. But only 10 minutes or so ago, we heard Mark reading out about how John the Baptist had come to a premature end. King Herod had had his head chopped off. Scuppered his chances of doing an Elijah. But hang on. This last bit we've just been listening to, the 3 disciples coming down the mountain with Jesus and asking about Elijah, and the suffering Jesus had been saying was in store for him, the Son of Man, as he described himself, and also in store for Elijah. So you probably imagine he's talking about the distant future. But Jesus then makes the shocking claim that Elijah has already been and gone. Not way back in the Old Testament, but just recently. And they did to him everything they pleased, he said. Quite a chilling way of putting it. No names, no gory details, but we all know who and what. And how shocking to talk about the great prophet who we always thought never died, as if he's John the Baptist. Something funny going on here. Now, let's take stock of where we've got to. We're witnessing a drama. Mark's gospel is a drama. Oh, and by the way, being ancient people, we're much more used to listening to stories being read out than modern people. And we're much better at remembering what we've heard. It's always worth bearing that in mind. Anyway, Mark started out with the story of Jesus' baptism and included some rather strange features in it. We've just had the story of Jesus' transfiguration, as it's known, with some of those same strange features again, or sort of. Before we look at the transfiguration itself, I'd like to look at how we got there. How did Mark move the story along to this point? And how has he prepared us for it? Good storytellers prepare the ground. They don't just plonk events down out of the blue. Since we heard the story of Jesus' baptism, we've had a lot of questions dropped into our ears. They're all questions about Jesus, asked by a range of different people. and we might end up expecting answers in some form or other. So here goes. I'll take you through some of the questions. Starting in chapter 1, on to chapter 7. Don't worry, only bits of them. Among a crowd in Galilee, people were saying, "What's this? A new teaching with authority? He commands even the unclean spirits, and they obey him." Or the scribes, "Why does this fellow speak this way? Who can forgive sins but God? And why does he eat with sinners?" Or the Pharisees, "Why are they doing what's not lawful?" His disciples, "Who is this that even wind and water obey him?" Folk in Nazareth, his hometown, "Where did this man get his wisdom from?" Pharisees again, "Why do your disciples not live by tradition?" This gets us from chapter 1 to chapter 7. In the process, we've had various other things, teaching with parables, for example, but the main thing has been miracles. I counted 16 of them. All but two of them are healings of one sort or another, and a couple are healings of many people together. No wonder people are asking questions. And as we've been listening to the reading, we may not have been thinking very theologically. We've wanted to know what happens next. But maybe a couple of ideas have occurred to us. Some scribes asked, "Who can forgive sins but God?" Good question. Dead right there. The disciples asked, "Who is this that even wind and water obey him?" There's a straight answer to that one. God Almighty, creator of heaven and earth. How does Mark give the answers to these questions? Maybe you think you know what's coming, the transfiguration of Jesus. Well, yes, but not quite yet. In the previous chapter, chapter 8, the questions have come to a climax in a little scene between Jesus and the disciples. Jesus tries a bit of market research on them and asks what people are saying about him. They give a short list of possible answers. He's John the Baptist, maybe, or Elijah, or another of the prophets, perhaps. "Okay," says Jesus, "what about you, you lot? What do you reckon?" It's Peter who answers, "You are the Messiah, the Christ." To the disciples, that doesn't necessarily mean quite that Jesus equals God, but whatever those words do or don't mean, a few words won't get us far if the reality is that Peter is speaking face to face with God himself. Maybe now's the time to join Peter, John, and James going up that mountain with Jesus. They're high up and well away from anyone else. Then something happens to Jesus. His clothes became a brilliant, dazzling white, and he was in the company of two other men who turn out to be Moses and Elijah. They're talking, but we don't find out a word of what they're talking about. Peter opens his big mouth, but not to any great purpose. Then suddenly, a cloud comes right down over them. And we hear a voice coming from it. "This is my son, the beloved. Listen to him." Cloud disappears. So do Moses and Elijah. And Jesus is back to normal again. What on earth do we make of it? Jesus doesn't really explain. He talks about Elijah as if he's John the Baptist, i.e. dead and gone, but that's about it. It occurred to me that one or two Bible stories might help a bit here. I thought of Moses and the burning bush, for instance. Moses sees this bush burning, and he's intrigued because the bush isn't being burnt up. He hears a voice that says, I'm the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. The voice says more about God and gives Moses a task to do. And Moses hid his face because he was scared to look at God. That was in Exodus. And remember how in Luke's gospel, the angel of the Lord appeared to the shepherds, and the glory and the glory of the Lord shone around them, and they were terrified. And the angel explains about the baby who's been born. Now, visions in the Bible don't always go like this, but these reveal something of the identity of God. And to the viewer or viewers, it's quite frightening. No surprise, I think, and in the story of Jesus' transfiguration, the disciples are pretty scared too. Wouldn't most of us be? This story grabs senses, emotions, and intellect in a way that Peter's simple statement that Jesus is the Messiah couldn't. Hollywood hasn't been invented yet, but Mark has a good go. This story is the halfway point in Mark's gospel. It's a kind of high point. Sorry about that, it sounds like a poor joke, but it's a serious point as well. And after the transfiguration, it's all downhill to the crucifixion. Just as the transfiguration picked up themes and motifs from the baptism, so the crucifixion story picks them up and turns them into something dark and quite nasty. As I was preparing this, I remembered that somewhere away in a folder I'd got a little chart which I thought might be worth showing. Could we have it up now, please? And I won't say a lot about it. But you can see baptism in chapter 1, transfiguration in chapter 9, and crucifixion in chapter 15. Number of items from each story picked out where there's one, either they either repeat something from the previous one or they sort of echo it. And it changes as we go through. The transfiguration I described as a high point. Remember the voice from heaven and the voice from the cloud in the baptism and transfiguration. When we get to the crucifixion, Jesus' loud voice. Hey, what's happened to God? This is terrible. Somebody who's been crucified as a criminal by the Romans. And yet, of course, it was God. You're my son, you're my beloved son in the baptism. This is my beloved son in the transfiguration. And then a Roman thug. Truly, this man was the Son of God. What on earth he thought he was saying, I don't know. But he may have been a thug, but he may have been in the beginning of being onto something. Elijah appears in each one, except in the crucifixion he doesn't. The crowd are sneering. Is this man calling to Elijah? No, he was calling on God, using the Hebrew or Aramaic name for God, and they were pretending that he was calling to Elijah. So, I said that ancient people were better at remembering what they'd heard than we are. I don't know exactly what anybody would have remembered, but that's what I think they've got to remember. And I guess quite a few of them would have remembered a certain amount, or quite a bit even. Is there anything in this story of the Transfiguration, though? Thanks, I'm not going to talk about the little chart anymore. Anything about the story for us to take away with us? Now, in general, I'm a bit suspicious of demands for practical application of everything and everything. But here, we've heard the voice of God. Maybe there's something to listen to. Well, God said, "This is my beloved son. Listen to him." He was talking to the disciples, but we might usefully wonder how to act on it ourselves. How do we listen to him? I'm asking that as a serious question. How do we listen to him? Mark gave us Jesus in stories to listen to. In the Middle Ages, or the Middle Ages and after, gave us paintings. I wondered about putting this up on screen, but they're so absurd that I thought I wouldn't bother. The Transfiguration tends to be made to look like three people dancing around several feet off the ground. No way to get modern viewers to take it seriously. It actually looks very funny to modern eyes, but it certainly wasn't meant to be. It was scary. So how might modern British people in our culture be persuaded to listen to him? I'm talking about Christians in churches, every bit as much as people who never darken the doors. Does the Bible reading slot in the morning service do it for you? Does it make you actually listen? I read as well as I could. I'm guessing the honest answer might be not a lot. Maybe you'd be more likely to keep paying attention to a professional actor on telly. Do you know, I reckon, and I have a subject I have very little knowledge of, I reckon the obvious answer is film. And before I finish, I'd like to make a practical suggestion. How many of you have seen any episodes of the film series on the life of Jesus called The Chosen? How many? A decent minority, thank you. Good, okay. It's coming out a bit at a time. It's not finished yet. If they include the Transfiguration, I seriously wonder whether they will or can, but if they do, it should be in the next lot. I was introduced to it by my daughter, Rachel, and when she's visiting, she mostly asks if I want if I want to see the next episode, and the answer is normally yes. I can pick minor quibbles here and there. I tend to think the Roman officials might have been a bit nastier. My toes curl at the way they pronounce Latin names. They add bits to the bare Gospels narrative, but to give necessary context. That's absolutely fine, I think. It helps to make sense of the story and the characters of Jesus and the disciples. When I read the Gospels, I want to meet Jesus. He was a real person. And I want to feel I'm meeting a real person in a real human setting. I think the film does that really well. Give it a try. But I still have a problem of sorts. Not with the film so much as, well, the original stories, as told in the four Gospels. Sometimes Jesus seems to talk in very simple language any child could understand. And sometimes I feel he's way over my head. I really do. But should that be surprising? If Jesus is completely human and completely God, would you expect to be able to get your head round him? He's got to be someone you can and want to relate to, and someone who demands that you worship him. That's a tall order, perhaps for a film or anything else. Jesus' Transfiguration shows us a divine Jesus, a greater lawgiver than Moses, a greater prophet than Elijah. But in the Transfiguration scene itself, he doesn't actually say anything. Only God the Father does. God's command is, listen to him. Now, I'm not much into films. Maybe there are others that would help as well as this one. But I would at least suggest watching The Chosen. I'll be interested to see how they handle the Transfiguration, if they even try. The human Jesus, whom we meet in the Gospels, is someone we need to get much more closely to grips with, I think. But the divine Jesus we've seen on the mountaintop, I think we can only worship him. How do we do that? That's what I hand over to you to think for yourselves. Thank you.